Chapter 2. The hermit fell on his knees, praising God. Then he rose and ran across the plain to the rock. As he drew near, he saw that the saint was a very old man, clad in goatskin, with a long white beard. He sat motionless, his hands on his knees, and two red eye sockets turned to the sunset. Near him was a young boy in skins who brushed the flies from his face. But they always came back, and settled on the room which ran from his eyes. He did not appear to hear or see the approach of the hermit, but sat quite still till the boy said, "Colon father, here is a pilgrim." Then he lifted up his voice, and asked angrily who was there, and what the stranger sought. The hermit answered, "Colon father, the report of your holy practices came to me a long way off, and being myself a solitary, though not worthy to be named with you for godliness, it seemed fitting that I should cross the mountains to visit you, that we might sit together and speak in praise of solitude." The saint replied, "Colon, you fool, how can two sit together and praise solitude, since by so doing they put an end to the thing they pretend to honor?" The hermit, at that, was sorely abashed, for he had thought his speech out on the way, reciting it many times over, and now it appeared to him vainer than the crackling of thorns under a pot. Nevertheless he took heart and said, "Colon true, father, but may not two sinners sit together and praise Christ, who has taught them the blessings of solitude?" But the other only answered, "Colon, if you had really learned the blessings of solitude, you would not squander them in idle wandering." And, the hermit not knowing how to reply, he said again, "If two sinners meet, they can best praise Christ, by going each his own way in silence." After that he shut his lips, and continued motionless while the boy brushed the flies from his eye sockets. But the hermit's heart sank, and for the first time he felt all the weariness of the way he had fared, and the great distance dividing him from home. He had meant to take counsel with the saint concerning his laws, and whether he ought to destroy them, but now he had no heart to say another word, and turning away he began to descend the mountain. Presently he heard steps running behind him, and the boy came up, and pressed a honeycomb in his hand. "You have come a long way, and must be hungry," he said. But before the hermit could thank him, he had hastened back to his task. So the hermit crept down the mountain till he reached the wood, where he had slept before, and there he made his bed again. But he had no mind to eat before sleeping, for his heart hungered more than his body, and his salt tears made the honeycomb bitter. 3. On the 14th day he came to the valley below his cliff, and saw the walls of his native town against the sky. He was footsore and heavy of heart, for his long pilgrimage had brought him only weariness and humiliation, and as no drop of rain had fallen he knew that his garden must have perished. So he climbed the cliff heavily, and reached his cave at the Angelus. But there a great wonder awaited him. For though the scant earth of the hillside was parched and crumbling, his garden soil reeked with moisture, and his plants had shot up, fresh and glistening, to a height they had never before attained. More wonderful still, the tendrils of the gourd had been trained about his door, and kneeling down he saw that the earth had been loosened between the rows of sprouting vegetables, and that every leaf sparkled with drops, as though the rain had but newly ceased. Then it appeared to the hermit that he beheld a miracle, but doubting his own deserts he refused to believe himself worthy of such grace, and went within doors to ponder on what had befallen him. And on his bed of rushes he saw a young woman sleeping, clad in an outlandish garment, with strange amulets about her neck. The sight was very terrifying to the hermit, for he recalled how often the demon, in tempting the desert fathers, had taken the form of a woman for their undoing, but he reflected that, since there was nothing pleasing to him in the sight of this female, who was brown as a nut and lean with wayfaring, he ran no great danger in looking at her. At first he took her for a wandering Egyptian, but as he looked he perceived, among the heathen charms, an anastai in her bosom, And this so surprised him that he bent over and called on her to wake. She sprang up with a start, but seeing the hermit's gown and staff, and his face above her, lay quiet and said to him, I have watered your garden daily in return for the beans and oil that I took from your store. Who are you, and how do you come here? Asked the hermit. She said, I am a wild woman and live in the woods. And when he pressed her again, to tell him why as he had sought shelter in his cave, she said that the land to the south, whence she came, was full of armed companies and bands of marauders, and that great license and bloodshed prevailed there, and this the hermit knew to be true, for he had heard of it on his homeward journey. The wild woman went on to tell him that as he had been hunted through the woods like an animal by a band of drunken men-at-arms, lanzknechts from the north by their barbarous dress and speech, and at length, starving and spent, had come on his cave, and hidden herself from her pursuers. For, she said, I fear neither wild beasts nor the woodland people, charcoal burners, Egyptians, wandering minstrels or chapmen. Even the highway robbers do not touch me, because I am poor and brown. But these armed men flown with blood and wine are more terrible than wolves and tigers. And the hermit's heart melted, for he thought of his little sister lying with her throat slit across the altar steps, and of the scenes of blood and rapine from which he had fled away into the wilderness. So he said to the stranger that it was not meet he should house her in his cave, but that he would send a messenger to the town across the valley, and beg a pious woman there to give her lodging and work in her household. For, said he, I perceive by the blessed image about your neck, that you are not a heathen wilding, but a child of Christ, though so far astray from him in the desert. Yes, she said, I am a Christian, and know as many prayers as you, but I will never set foot in city walls again, lest I be caught, and put back into the convent. What, cried the hermit with a start, you are a runagate nun. And he crossed himself, and again thought of the demon. She smiled and said, it is true I was once a cloistered woman, but I will never willingly be one again. Now drive me forth if you like, but I cannot go far, for I have a wounded foot, which I got in climbing the cliff with water for your garden. And she pointed to a deep cut in her foot. At that, for all his fear, the hermit was moved to pity, and washed the cut and bound it up, and as he did, so he bethought him that perhaps his strange visitor had been sent to him not for his soul's undoing, but for her own salvation. And from that hour he earnestly yearned to save her. But it was not fitting that she should remain in his cave. So, having given her water to drink, and a handful of lentils, he raised her up and putting his staff in her hand guided her to a hollow not far off in the face of the cliff. And while he was doing this, he heard the sunset bells ring across the valley, and set about reciting the Angelus Domini Nuntiavit Mariae, and she joined in very piously, with her hands folded, not missing a word. Nevertheless the thought of her wickedness weighed on him, and the next day, when he went to carry her food he asked her to tell him how it came about that as he had fallen into such abominable sin. And this is the story she told. I was born, said she, in the north country, where the winters are long and cold, where snow sometimes falls in the valleys, and the high mountains for months are white with it. My father's castle is in a tall green wood, where the winds always rustle, and a cold river runs down from the ice gorges. South of us was the wide plain, glowing with heat, but above us were stony passes, where the eagle nests and the storms howl. In winter great fires roared in our chimneys, and even in summer there was always a cool air off the gorges. But when I was a child my mother went southward in the great empress's train, and I went with her. We traveled many days, across plains and mountains, and saw Rome, where the Pope lives in a golden palace, and many other cities, till we came to the great emperor's court. There for 2 years or more we lived in pomp and merriment, for it was a wonderful court, full of mimes, magicians, philosophers and poets, And the empress's ladies spent their days in mirth and music, dressed in light silken garments, walking in gardens of roses, and bathing in a great cool marble tank, while the emperor's eunuchs guarded the approach to the gardens. Oh, those baths in the marble tank, my father! I used to lie awake through the whole hot southern night, and think of that plunge at sunrise under the last stars. For we were in a burning country, and I pined for the tall green woods, and the cold stream of my father's valley, and when I had cooled my limbs in the tank I lay all day in the scant cypress shade, and dreamed of my next bath. My mother pined for the coolness till she died. Then the empress put me in a convent, and I was forgotten. The convent was on the side of a bare yellow hill, where bees made a hot buzzing in the time. Below was the sea, blazing with a million shafts of light, and overhead a blinding sky, which reflected the sun's glitter like a huge baldric of steel. Now the convent was built on the site of an old pleasure house which a holy princess had given to our order, and a part of the house was left standing with its court and garden. The nuns had built all about the garden, but they left the cypresses in the middle, and the long marble tank, where the princess and her ladies had bathed. The tank, however, as you may conceive, was no longer used as a bath, for the washing of the body is an indulgence forbidden to cloistered virgins, and our abbess, who was famed for her austerities, boasted that, like holy Sylvia the nun, she never touched water save to bathe her fingertips before receiving the sacrament. With such an example before them, the nuns were obliged to conform to the same pious rule, and many, having been bred in the convent from infancy, regarded all ablutions with horror, and felt no temptation to cleanse the filth from their flesh. But I, who had bathed daily, had the freshness of clear water in my veins, and perished slowly for want of it, like your garden herbs in a drought. My cell did not look on the garden, but on the steep mule path leading up the cliff, where all day long the sun beat, as if with flails of fire, and I saw the sweating peasants toil up and down behind their thirsty asses, and the beggars whining and scraping their sores in the heat. Oh, how I hated to look out through the bars on that burning world! I used to turn away from it, sick with disgust, and lying on my hard bed, stare up by the hour at the ceiling of my cell. But flies crawled in hundreds on the ceiling, and the hot noise they made was worse than the glare. Sometimes, at an hour when I knew myself unobserved, I tore off my stifling gown, and hung it over the grated window, that I might no longer see the shaft of hot sunlight lying across my cell, and the dust dancing in it like fat in the fire. But the darkness choked me, and I struggled for breath, as though I lay at the bottom of a pit, so that at last I would spring up, and dragging down the dress, fling myself on my knees before the cross, and entreat our Lord to give me the gift of holiness, that I might escape the everlasting fires of hell, of which this heat was like an awful foretaste. For if I could not endure the scorching of a summer's day, with what constancy could I meet the thought of the flame that deeth not? This longing to escape the heat of hell made me apply myself to a devouter way of living, and I reflected that, if my bodily distress were somewhat eased, I should be able to throw myself with greater zeal into the practice of vigils and austerities. And at length, having set forth to the abbess that the sultry air of my cell induced in me a grievous heaviness of sleep, I prevailed on her to lodge me in that part of the building which overlooked the garden. For a few days I was quite happy, for instead of the moldy mountainside, and the sight of the sweating peasants and their asses, I looked out on dark cypresses and rows of budding vegetables. But presently I found I had not bettered myself. For with the approach of midsummer the garden, being all enclosed with buildings, grew as stifling as my cell. All the green things in it withered and dried off, leaving trenches of bare red earth, across which the cypresses cast strips of shade too narrow to cool the aching heads of the nuns who sought shelter there, And I began to think sorrowfully of my former cell, where now and then there came a sea breeze, hot and languid, yet alive, and where at least I could look out upon the sea. But this was not the worst, for when the dog days came I found that the sun, at a certain hour, cast on the ceiling of my cell the reflection of the ripples on the garden tank, and to say how I suffered from this sight is not within the power of speech. It was indeed agony, to watch the clear water rippling and washing above my head, yet feel no solace of it on my limbs, as though I had been a senseless brazen image lying at the bottom of a well. But the image, if it felt no refreshment, would have suffered no torture, whereas every inch of my skin throbbed with thirst, and every vein was a mouth of dives praying for a drop of water. Oh, Father, how shall I tell you the grievous pains that I endured? Sometimes I so feared the sight of the mocking ripples overhead, that I hid my eyes from their approach, lying face down on my burning bed till I knew that they were gone. Yet on cloudy days, when they did not come, the heat was even worse to bear. By day I hardly dared trust myself in the garden, for the nuns walked there, and one fiery noon they found me hanging so close above the tank that they snatched me away, crying out that I had tried to destroy myself. The scandal of this reaching the abbess, she sent for me to know what demon had beset me, and when I wept and said, the longing to bathe my burning body, she broke into great anger, and cried out, do you not know that this is a sin well nigh as great as the other, and condemned by all the greatest saints? For a nun may be tempted to take her life through excess of self-scrutiny and despair of her own worthiness. But this desire to indulge the despicable body is one of the lusts of the flesh, to be classed with concupiscence and adultery. And she ordered me to sleep every night for a month in my heavy gown, with a veil upon my face. Now, Father, I believe it was this penance that drove me to sin. For we were in the dog days, and it was more than flesh could bear. And on the third night, after the portress had passed, and the lights were out, I rose and flung off my veil and gown, and knelt in my window fainting. There was no moon, but the sky was full of stars. At first the garden was all blackness, but as I looked I saw a faint twinkle between the cypress trunks, and I knew it was the starlight on the tank. The water! The water! It was there close to me only a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.